whose talk is called The Heart's Release. Contemporary Chinese written character for love was developed out of two ancient pictographs or symbols. The top symbol was a very simple one representing a person breathing, a symbol for breath. And the bottom symbol was one for the heart. So in Chinese pictographic writing, the word or the symbol for love is breath through the heart, or breathing through the heart. We will begin to explore the liberation of the heart, the heart's release. Metta is one of four particular wholesome qualities or capacities of the mind, capacities of the heart, that are called the Brahma-viharas, which translates as the heavenly abodes or the divine abodes. These capacities are also sometimes called the immeasurables, because as they emerge and as they mature, they blossom into boundless, immeasurable capacities of being. These divine abidings are actually expressions of what is sometimes called the original mind or the original heart, as I mentioned last evening. The heart, the mind that's clear, pure, that's unfettered, unbound by the layers and the knots of conditioned reactive habit patterns that cause us to suffer, and that keep us disconnected, keep us shut off. The immeasurables are not created through our practice, but are uncovered by means of a process in which one faces and moves through the conditioned habit patterns that obscure or blind stand in the way of the divine abidings. As we repeatedly offer ourselves the possibility of connecting with the various facets or the qualities of each of these immeasurable capacities. We don't need to acquire metta. We don't need to acquire equanimity. They're already in our heart in abundance, as we began to explore last evening. Rather, we need to see and to let go of the fear and the ill will that obscures these capacities. Each and all of the Brahma-viharas are perfectly natural, absolutely natural aspects of our humanness. So in this way, in this sense, we could say that they're really quite ordinary. And at the same time, they're extraordinary. Extraordinary capacities of being. As these wholesome and beautiful qualities of our humanness, of our human heart, begin to emerge and to become more stable, moving towards a limitless, boundless maturity, we begin to know, to live what we could call the heart's release. At any moment, and maybe sustaining briefly, maybe for the duration of the snap of a finger, as the Buddha talked about, any one of us might experience our heart, our mind, totally free. Totally free from aversion, totally free from ill will. And experience the purity of kindness, the purity of goodwill. No matter what's happening, no matter what's happening inwardly or outwardly. Absolute kind-heartedness, the purity of metta, the heart's release. The Buddha spoke about this experience as making one a truly spiritual person. So these four divine abidings, four immeasurables, these four aspects of the enlightened heart, enlightened love, be it relatively cool and impersonal love, is the primary essential quality of the enlightened heart. So the first divine abiding is metta, unconditional kind-heartedness, unconditional acceptance, friendship. The second is karuna, compassion. Growing into a boundless compassion in relationship to suffering. And the third is mudita, appreciative or empathetic joy. The joy or taking delight in relationship to others' happiness, in relationship to others' successes, with no envy, no jealousy, no judgment, as well as experiencing the joy and the delight in relationship to our own success, our own happiness. And the last of these four capacities is upekkha, equanimity. The spaciousness, the balance, and the non-reactivity of the heart, of the mind. It's a cooling of the fires and a balance in the light of all that comes, all that goes within us and around us, of metta or unconditional loving kindness as being the most powerful and the most subtle energy in the universe. Metta is the energy that connects. It's the energy that keeps it all together. A short piece from Krishnamurti's meditation journal. When the heart enters into the mind has quite a different quality. It's really then limitless. It's a sense of living in a vast space where you're part of everything. Meditation is the movement of love. It isn't the love of the one or of the many. It's like water that anyone can drink out of any jar, whether golden or earthenware. And you must begin without knowing anything about it and move from innocence to innocence. This jar that anyone can drink out of, this jar of metta, whether it's golden or whether it's earthenware, this immeasurable capacity to connect with and to accept without choosing, without rejecting, kind-heartedness with immeasurable impartiality. Impartially respecting, impartially embracing all sentient beings, not just those that we're close to or those who might be useful to us in some way, or those that are pleasing to us or amusing to us. But the possibility of an open-hearted impartiality. It's a wonderful poem, a metaphoric teaching by Hafiz that speaks of this. It's called "The Sun Never Says." And this is Hafiz's poem. Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, "You owe me." Look at what happens with a love like that. It lights up the whole sky. As we practice metta, we begin to uncover and cultivate a love that's really, truly great, a greatness of heart that's not conditioned, that's not finite, but is fearless and open. With even just one moment of experiencing this, we're deeply refreshed, as though breathing fresh, clean air into the heart. In that moment, we're washed clean, we could say, purified of all ill will towards beings, including ourselves. The Buddha spoke many, many times over his 45 years of teaching about how powerful and how consequential it is to experience just one moment of a mind, a heart, absorbed in the feeling of metta. We could say that this practice of the heart is the heart of practice. Although we feel, although we experience metta personally, it's actually a totally impersonal quality, a totally impersonal capacity. Of metta, the still heart of absolute acceptance, a moment when the sense of separation, a sense of preference, of difference, any sense of discrimination has disappeared, is absent, even just for a moment. This can be called love, metta-love. And it's really the ground that all of the other divine abidings spring from. It's also the ground that allows the whole of our practice, insight, vipassana practice, to unfold, which itself, in turn, continues the process of purification and the blossoming of acceptance, of kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity. And I think it's very important to note here that it's not a linear process. It's not first one and then the other. The practices all dance together, aiding and supporting each other. One of my Burmese teachers, Sayadaw Upandita, used to say, or probably still does, he said that people think that everything begins and ends here, and he'd knock himself on the head. And then he'd say, "But I've been checking for a long, long time." Now, he's about 86 years, 87 years old now, and he was a monk, I think, starting at about the age of 14. So he's been checking for quite a long time. And he said that, "I found that everything begins and ends here. And he tapped himself on his chest at his heart center. Everything begins and ends here. So after hearing him say this a number of times, I thought it would be worth checking. So I checked. And it seems so. It seems that everything does begin and end here in the heart. Practice in the very specific ways of the metta practice and teachings. As the purification of the heart and the mind takes place, as your practice develops and blossoms, there's a very natural unfolding, a natural ripening of patience, of confidence, of fearlessness, trust, of joy, happiness. There's a natural opening and ripening into a loving heart that contains all of these qualities. The various flavors of ill will, such as hostility or judgment, anger, hatred, dislike, fear, that we may have experienced towards ourselves, we may have experienced towards others, they begin to subside. The practice of metta actually weakens these aversive states. In a certain sense, we could describe metta as secluding or cloistering the heart, the mind, from anger, from fear. The deepest strength of its medicine, metta medicine. It breaks down, it dismantles, it unwinds, it unbinds the heart from states of anger, fear, judgment. All of these states being states of separation. These strong energies that move through the mind, through the body, through the heart, begin to weaken and begin to fade under the strong light, under the strong medicine of a loving heart. The more moments of a true metta, the less moments of anger, worry, anxiety, fear. It's actually not possible to feel unconditional acceptance, friendship, unconditional kindness. It's not possible to feel these things at the same time that we feel aversive states. We can't feel both at the same time. So obviously the more moments of metta, the less moments of fear, anger, hatred. Once asked Nisargadatta Maharaj, who was an Indian teacher who taught through dialogue with his students, someone once asked him, "What can make me love?" And his response was, "You are love when you're not afraid. You are love when you're not afraid." I think that every one of us essentially wants to be loving. Essentially, we each want to be able to truly love. It's a natural human inclination. And we've tasted it. Maybe just momentarily, or maybe longer than momentarily. And we know that when we're in this state, there's a sense of not needing anything. There's a sense of having what we need. That it all just comes, it all just is. That whatever comes, whatever is just enough. practice of loving kindness for ourselves and for others is basically characterized by wishing well. Wishing well for ourselves and wishing well for others. In as clear and unfettered, uncomplicated a way as possible. And as I've already mentioned, metta and the other divine abidings or the other immeasurables are uncovered and developed through our meditation practice. It's not about acquiring kind-heartedness. It's actually in our heart in abundance, as we've already spoken about. Process of practice, this process of purification, is not about bypassing the habits of mind that lie between us and enlightened love. It's not about bypassing these, but about recognizing and letting go of clinging, of fear, hatred, and the ignorance that obscure, that cover metta, that cover compassion, that cover or obscure appreciative joy and equanimity. So we could say that the Buddha's way works by subtraction. We get to awakening, we get to enlightenment by removing whatever stands between the goal and us. So the way lies directly through all of the kilesas, a Pali word, maybe some of you know that word, directly through what are sometimes, it's sometimes translated as defilements or cankers, as the Buddha often called them. Cankers in English are these terrible sores that are very painful. The way lies directly through these cankers, which actually must be quite courageously seen and accepted for what they are and purified by diligent practice. Our practice isn't about making metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha into goals. Instead, show up to look when the things that the states that stand in the way of these divine abidings show up, to look at ill will, to look at cruelty, envy, jealousy, agitation, fear, anger, attachment that might be in your heart, in your mind. And then let go of them little by little as best you can. And in this way, we naturally grow into kind-heartedness, compassion, rejoicing, and dispassion or equanimity. And maybe one day then we can say, as the Dalai Lama says, my religion is kindness. Unfolds feelings of annoyance, irritation, criticism, anxiety, worry. They all slowly and sometimes quickly weaken. These difficult aversive states begin to subside as we begin to connect naturally, connect internally with them and with the truth of our heart. We truly begin to feel a connection with ourselves. We begin to feel a connection in relationship to others. A connection, a caring that needs no conditions met in order for it to arise, for it to exist. And again, it's impersonal in nature. Even in relationship to what we think of and are often very attached and very identified to as ourself, our body, our mind, metta is accepting. It's non-critical, non-judgmental in relationship to our body, for instance, and in relationship to the mind with all of its moods, its emotions, the various thoughts, the various memories that come through. Metta isn't interested in comparing. It isn't interested in criticizing. It allows things to be as they are, with a sense of well-being within us, with patience, acceptance, with goodwill. Metta and aversion don't or can't exist at the same time. Metta doesn't depend on liking someone, liking another person. It doesn't even depend on approving of them. It actually has nothing to do with approving of. Metta, we're able to connect with beings beneath that which we may not agree with, and even that which we may not condone. Metta is accepting on a very deep universal level. But it's not necessarily approving. It's non-critical. It doesn't compare, as I've already said. It doesn't favor one over the other. So it's not divisive. It doesn't divide. It's a unifying energy. It brings things together. It's goodwill equally towards all beings. And it's not easy, as I'm sure you're understanding. Our ordinary, our conventional relative notions of love contain certain energies of attachment, of possessiveness, of conditionality. Traditional teachings of metta. Metta is compared to a mother's unconditional love for her only child. And in the words of the Buddha, he says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Developing and deepening heart of loving kindness, we're less and less inclined to kind of get stuck. In English, the word is wallow in difficult or afflictive states of mind. We're less inclined towards reacting with anger or getting stuck in self-pity or pitying another person when difficult or afflictive states of mind come up. We're less and less inclined to criticize ourselves, to judge ourselves, and less inclined to criticize and judge others. And we also don't obsessively try to find or kind of root out ours or another's weaknesses or faults, or what we think of as weaknesses or faults. Sometimes we have a habit of doing that. We're less inclined to do that once metta starts taking root. We're less inclined to get stuck for too long in our own conditioned habit patterns, which we may have quite a strong and long-time identification with. In relationship to ourselves, for instance, we may have an identification as being a fearful person. I'm a fearful person. Or I'm an angry person. Or I'm a sad person. I'm a depressed person. Or I'm always cheerful. I'm always happy. That's how I am. That's me. We're less inclined to get stuck with identifying another person. We're less inclined to lock someone else into a particular identity that's connected with some emotional state. Sort of such as, he's always sad. She's a fearful, weak person. That's how she is. It's just her. He's always angry. Or she's always in a good mood. None of this is fair. None of it is true. Even though we may have a habit of identifying people this way. This, which includes a willingness to begin to see and begin to know these difficult states of mind. To really be open to them and to see and know these aspects of ourself and others with kindness, with a relationship of kindness, a relationship of spaciousness, and with a patient, mindful awareness. And then we begin to actually learn to be with ourselves in ways that are sometimes more easily accessed in relationship to others, maybe to a friend. We can learn to be with ourselves and see all of the different manifestations of our bodily experience, of emotional states of mind, of heart, and all of the various manifestations of thought, coming and going and changing. We learn to approach them with kindness, with the acceptance of a patient heart, as maybe fear or sadness, jealousy, anger, joy, delight, wanting, clinging, dullness, boredom, attachment, any of these, as they all arise, change, and pass. When our practice is couched or held in metta, we don't create another layer of difficulty, another layer of suffering on top of what's already taking place by being averse to it, by being antagonistic to it, or by being attached or clinging to any particular state of mind, any particular state of body. Just with metta as the attitude, with an attitude of metta, metta with an attitude of metta, in relationship to our experience, we find that there can actually be quite a deep sense of well-being inside, with no aversion, or with maybe very little, or a very quickly passing aversion to uncomfortable or difficult physical or mental experience. Trying to hold on, or trying to grasp and cling and hold on out of habit, or trying to force particular states of mind that are, or states of body that are very comfortable, that are pleasant, can also cause great difficulty, can also cause much anguish. They also continually pass away, just like everything else. And so, as we did today, we begin our metta practice with ourselves, with all of our moods, feelings that might be difficult, experiences in the body that might be difficult, beautiful feelings, beautiful experiences as well, and not demanding that they not be here if it's uncomfortable or unpleasant, or not demanding that they, that certain experiences stay, that they don't go away if they're pleasant, if they're comfortable. We're learning how to practice with what I call a radical acceptance, which is really the basis of the heart of metta. Emotions, sensations, feelings, thoughts naturally arise and pass. It's their nature. You don't feel anger all of the time, do you? Do you? You're not fearful every second of your life, are you? You don't feel delight constantly, do you? It comes, it goes. It's its nature, it's the nature of experience. Struggling with what comes, struggling with what goes, fighting it, trying to get rid of it, for instance, actually perpetuates it. We get stuck in it. When we struggle with it, when we fight with it, when we try to push it away, we get stuck in it. I sometimes think of it as Velcro practice. I don't know how to say that in Hebrew, but that stuff that sticks to itself doesn't let go. Learning to abide in the sense of well-being, which means developing this sense of acceptance, patience, non-criticism toward the body, toward the conditions that arise in the mind, the habits, the memories, good and bad, the reactions, allowing them to be what they are in the moment. They're simply just what they are. This is how it is in this moment. The quality, the capacity of kind-heartedness is a seed that we all have, that we all know, that we've all experienced as we explored in the reflection last evening. So from this perspective, it's not about working to attain something, but rather allowing the practice of metta to be metta itself. I think it's interesting that for many of us, with a dear friend, when we're with a dear friend, we don't usually demand that they stop feeling what they're feeling, especially if they're being very honest with us and sharing their feelings with us. We usually treat them kindly. We listen to them. We treat them with respect, with care. Can we also do this with ourselves, for ourselves? And wisdom, metta, and understanding arise when we begin to accept all of the different beings, we could say, both within ourselves and outside of ourselves. rather than trying to manipulate or ignore all these beings. Unconditional love is deep understanding. Unconditional love is wisdom. Understanding, wisdom, is unconditional love. Metta medicine is one of the best medicines. It's a very powerful medicine. Open heart is really intuitively, naturally loving. Connection and generosity are absolutely natural human capacities. And we see this in the smallest children. Some years ago now, I was feeding or attempting to feed one of my granddaughters when she was 7 months old. I was giving her a banana. And as I reached out to give her the banana, she took it from my hand and then she stuffed it in my mouth. Feeding me. It wasn't mean. It was a very innocent and pure expression of the heart of kindness. I was reading a book that was about a man, a 102-year-old black man, whose name is George Dawson. He grew up in his family's farm in the United States, in East Texas. And he was the grandson of slaves. At the age of 8, George had to go to work to help support the family, so he never went to school and he never learned how to read. Until the age of 98, when he decided to attend a literacy program. So at the age of 98, he learned how to read. And then he wrote a book about himself. It's quite an amazing and quite an inspiring book. Very illuminating book. George describes how he learned to read the world and survive in it. So I'd like to just share a little bit of this book with you. At one point in the book, George is having a conversation with Richard. And Richard is the man who helped George write the book. And they're talking together about George, who at the age of 101 was still living alone. And as George says, doing just fine. So Richard speaking. You're not really alone. People come and call on you all day long. There's a community of people that cares about you. You live by yourself, but no, you're not alone. And George responds, that's right. You figured that out. Yes, it's nice that people stop by like they do. But they do that because they want to. I have nothing to give them. But they always feel better when they leave. Richard, that sounds like a riddle. George, it does, doesn't it? I'll tell you the answer for that. All my life, I've been good to people. In all those years, every person I met, I've treated with respect. People do the same for me. Richard, what goes around comes around. George, that's right. It all comes back, everything you do. Sometimes it might take a while, that's all. I tell people not to worry about things, not to worry about their lives. Things will be all right. People need to hear that. Life is good just as it is. There isn't anything I would change about my life. Richard. People worry too much? George. That's right. Be happy. Be happy for what you have. Help somebody instead of worrying. It'll make a person feel better. It's good to be generous. It doesn't take much to make a difference. Even the poorest man can just take the time to say hello. That can be a help. Have some sympathy for somebody's hard luck story. It's not about money. Give what you can, and if you have nothing, at least pray for somebody. Have good thoughts. The practice of metta is metta itself. In the process of the cultivation, this prompting of unconditional loving kindness is the purification of its opposites. What in the classical teachings are called the far enemies of metta. Energies such as anger, jealousy, envy, hatred. All of the various forms that ill will takes. The opposites of metta that we've already explored to some degree this evening. And also in the process of uncovering and deepening this unconditional, caring heart, there's the purification of what are called the near enemies of metta, or what looks like love, or what our conditioned habits of mind sometimes mistake for love. Possessiveness, greed, the I need, I want, I must have mind. In the U.S., there are some advertisements, maybe they're here in Israel as well, for products, objects. And the wording says, this is a must have. You'll love it. That's a mistaken notion. There are so many ways that we're culturally conditioned into mistaking attachment, mistaking possessiveness, mistaking greed for love. Certainly, advertising is one of these ways. Very strong conditioning. And also songs, films, literature to some degree. All of these venues, not always, but certainly sometimes, promoting confusion, promoting a lot of anguish. For instance, telling us that love hurts. Love doesn't hurt. It doesn't, really. It's the near enemies and the far enemies that hurt, not love. We suffer in greed. We suffer in possessiveness. We suffer in jealousy, anger, fear, hatred. Unconditional loving kindness. That love that needs no conditions to be met. There's no suffering. There's no anguish in this. Important, essentially important, that we don't pretend anything in our practice. That we don't think or act out of some idealized concept of what we think a really loving, compassionate, really spiritual person would be like. How we think we should be if we're really a spiritual person. be honest, to really be honest with ourselves. A few years ago now, I received something in the mail from someone. It was I was told that it was a prayer of Mother Teresa's, and that it was one of her daily practices. Mother Teresa being a person that many people thought was quite a saintly person. And she really was quite an amazing person in how she lived her life and what she did for other people. So this is this prayer, her daily, I was told, part of her daily practice. And I'll read it to you just as it was sent to me. Deliver me, O Jesus, from the desire of being loved, from the desire of being extolled, from the desire of being honored, from the desire of being praised, from the desire of being preferred, from the desire of being consulted, from the desire of being approved, from the desire of being popular, from the fear of being humiliated, from the fear of being despised, from the fear of suffering rebukes, from the fear of being calumniated, from the fear of being forgotten, from the fear of being wronged, from the fear of being ridiculed, from the fear of being suspected. Shortly after I received this, a friend called me on the phone, and I said, oh, I have to read you this prayer that I got in the mail. And I told him it was Mother Teresa's part of her daily practice. So I read it to him, and his response was, oh my God, have I got a lot of work to do. It's true. We have a lot of work to do. But actually, every time I read that prayer, I feel quite inspired. It's quite an inspiring practice for me. For you, also. In our formal practice, in our life as our practice, we have the opportunity to meet, to come face to face, and to recognize the conditional states of mind that aren't metta, and to meet them without identifying with them as who we are, as who I am. We can learn to accept these states as they arise and pass, as they come and go. Like all phenomena, arises and passes, comes and goes. They can be very strong energies, it's true. But they do come and go. Practice reveals the patterns that run our lives. And it may be that we don't always like what we see. But if we turn away from them, they're the ones that win. They win. And they continue to operate. They continue to run our life. We need to recognize the variety of experiences or the results that practice can produce, used by the pleasant, not be put off by the unpleasant, not be put to sleep by the neutral. Pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral responses to experience can trigger emotional reactions of attraction, attachment, or various aversive states, or indifference, all of which are formed around and maintain, support the sense of I, of me, of mine. With metta practice, we observe and recognize our reaction to opening to ourselves, to opening to others, seeing the reactive patterns that prevent the particular immeasurable capacity from happening, from manifesting. We learn that shutting down blocks loving kindness. It may be somewhat uncomfortable as you see how patterns operate, but the discomfort itself is actually part of the reactive process. It's part of the way it operates. If you buy into it, or if you buy it, if you identify with it, it can erode the attention. It can erode mindful presence and stop our metta practice. So practice isn't about avoiding feelings of discomfort, but really about holding the pattern and the reactions in awareness. And at some point we begin to experience a shift. We begin to see through the reactive pattern. It becomes empty at that point. This shift can come quite suddenly, or it can come gradually. In any case, at some point you realize that all of the turmoil inside has vanished, and you're in a very different state of mind. The shift has the quality of opening, relaxing, and knowing. And it marks the arising of metta. Relaxation and openness are important marks of the arising of metta. The relationship with metta isn't yet stable at this point. And so this process may occur many, many times. Metta arising and fading. Coming, coming back, and going. So we come back to holding the reactive pattern in awareness. Mindful awareness. Again, until it empties. And then resting in this. And on it goes, sometimes many times. Until at some point in time, the underlying core of the reactive pattern, the reactive emotional pattern, falls apart. And metta becomes a stable experience. A stable quality of the heart, a stable quality of the mind. So, again, as we did today, we begin this practice with ourselves. Connecting with and watching our own heart, our own mind. And slowly expanding outward from here, this place. Eventually connecting, eventually encompassing every form of life on the planet, every form of life in the universe, those seen and unseen. As an example of the stability and the beauty of a heart, a mind, steeped in kind-heartedness, I'd like to share a little bit again from our 102-year-old Bodhisattva, George Dawson. And just a little preface about George. For much of his life, George endured a very pervasive racism and segregation that was going on in the South, in the United States, as he grew up in East Texas. And during the time that he grew up there, East Texas had the highest rate of lynchings of any state in the Union. And actually, this book begins with George when he was 8 years old, as he was witnessing the lynching of a teenage boy who was his hero. At 65 years old, he was doing yard work, garden work, for a woman who had left his lunch on the back porch with her dogs. And this is George speaking. "She didn't see me from the shadow of the trees, but I watched as she put down two bowls on the floor for some dogs, and another she set up on the shelf that was above the reach of the dogs. I climbed up on the porch and lifted the bowl off the shelf. It looked good, and as hungry as I was, it smelled even better. I was looking for a chair to sit in a quiet spot to say prayers, to say grace, when I looked down and saw the two dogs eating the food that was there, the same food that was on the shelf in the bowl for me. There wasn't such a surprise in that. People didn't buy dog food in the sack like they do now. Dogs mostly ate the leftovers from the table. But what hit me was that she expected that I would eat out on the porch with the dogs. I didn't have to eat in their dining room, but back in their kitchen would have been all right. I told myself that I was good enough to eat a meal with people, not dogs. So I set the bowl back on the shelf. Being hungry, that wasn't so easy. I know she didn't plan to insult me. She just didn't know any better. Still, she could believe what she wanted, but I wasn't an animal. I wasn't going to eat with dogs. If I did, she would go on believing that way, and maybe she would have been right. Late in the afternoon, she came by, and she said, 'Didn't you see the lunch that I left on the porch?' I nodded. 'I saw the dogs on the porch.' And she said, 'Well, the lunch on the shelf was for you. It was a good lunch.' And George said, 'It was. It's just that I don't eat with dogs.' And as I said that, I looked her straight in the eye. I could tell she understood what I meant. She got angry and red in the face. But I didn't turn away. I didn't look down. 'I eat with people,' I said. 'I'm a human being.' At my words, her face tightened, and her look changed to meanness and anger. From her mother and father, and back through her grandparents, I could see 100 years of anger and fear coming out towards me. I stood up to it, and I repeated, 'I'm a human being.' She was so angry, she couldn't speak. I waited. Finally, in a cold tone, she said, 'You don't need to come back anymore.' And I said, 'That's right, I don't need to.'" And George goes on to say, "I figure you can't hate someone for what they think and do. But you can hate yourself for the unacceptable ways you react to it." In the transformation, the opening to the greatness of heart. There's a great letting go, a release, a relinquishment of what we've held onto. Much of what we've grasped onto very tightly. There's a great release of the contractions of the heart, the past pains, the hurts, the anguish that we've taken on and taken in as mine, as me, as who I am. And it's not so easy to relinquish this conditioning, these habituated patterns of ourself. But this is what binds the heart. This is what binds the mind. Our commitment to our practice, our willingness to take the journey. This is what affords the transformation. And it's not so easy at times, but it's very well worth it. There's a tremendous fullness of energy, which is constituted by great confidence, strength, and a very clear straightforwardness that comes through from a loving heart. The heart of metta. And I'd like to close the talk with something that one of my students gave me. On February 14th, maybe you have this holiday here. Hallmark may have made its way to to Israel as well. We have Valentine's Day on February 14th, which is actually a holiday I like. And this is a Valentine that a student sent me this last February 14th. And she wrote this. She and her husband wrote this. The Valentine came, it's a poem, which I'll read in a moment. And it had a little sticker, about that big, red sticker. And printed on it, it said, "This is love." And this is the poem, the Valentine poem. "Take this tiny label. Stick it on your dining table. Stick it on your favorite book. Stick it where you always look. Stick it on some brand new shoes. Stick it on the evening news. Stick it on a broken heart. Stick it on a hospice chart. Stick it on a violin. Stick it on your thinnest skin. Stick it on a long lost friend. Stick it on a bill to send. Stick it on your desk or wall. Use it on a conference call. Stick it on a microphone. Feel it when you're all alone. Put it on a mirror. Yes. See it when your hair's a mess. Stick it on the Senate floor, the White House door. Stick it on the other side. Stick it where it cannot hide. Can you see love everywhere? We hope we can. We hope we dare." Sit for just a moment.